Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's an encore edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
An 11-year-old boy playing baseball stops running, clutches his chest, and falls to the ground. He cannot be resuscitated. One of his brothers survives a similar attack, and no one can figure out why until a medical team at the University of Iowa discovered an unknown genetic disorder. Dr. Ian Law is the Division Director of Pediatric Cardiology and Director of the Electrophysiology Program at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He specializes in treating children with heart arrhythmias, and he led the team that solved this medical mystery. Hannah Bombi was also part of the team. She is a licensed and certified genetic counselor at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and they are both with me this morning. Hello, Dr. Law.
Good morning, Charity.
And hello, Hannah.
Good morning.
Thank you both so much for being here. And Dr. Law, your role in this started, I believe, in 2013 with a family that had moved to Iowa from Wisconsin. And I described a little bit of the scenario. They had lost one son and another had survived an incident like this. So where do you start with something like this?
Yeah, it's these are the challenging situations we face in as arrhythmia specialists, and when a child comes in this situation, there's a myriad of things that can cause someone to have a sudden cardiac arrest, and so you have to start from the top. Is it something structural? Is the heart too thick? Is there a valve abnormality? And those can be ruled out fairly easily by doing an ultrasound of the heart. And then you think of other things that might cause it that are arrhythmias, we call channelopathies, where the ion flow within the cardiac cells, the heart cells, isn't normal. And that's when you don't see anything abnormal, then you have to assume that it's something with an ion channel defect. And you try to get details about what the situation is. In this situation, all the events occurred when they were active. And so, and surprisingly, baseball was very popular with this family, and they would often play baseball and collapse. And so there are certain arrhythmias that are associated with activity, and so you focus on those. And we had done some testing. We did 24-hour EKGs on them. We had them run on treadmills, and we could not find any specific etiology. So then we resorted to genetic testing, and at the time, there weren't the genetic tests that could detect the family's arrhythmia. So we were stuck with what to do with these children.
And I mentioned two brothers, but this was a large family.
There's a large pedigree, a large family tree. And when we asked the family, one of the things when you have a child that has a sudden cardiac arrest, the family history can be very important. So if there are other people dying in the family, then it points you in a different direction. If it's only one individual, then you think, well, maybe they had a viral infection of the heart, and like even the coronavirus can cause an infection in the heart and then cause the heart to not function normally. But when it's a large family pedigree, a large family tree, then you have to start thinking about something that can be inherited, which puts you down in a different direction.
All right. And in this case, you had one child who had passed away, another sibling who had survived an attack like this, and then yet another sibling in the family also experienced this kind of crisis.
And the question that we have and the parents have is, who's next and how do we figure out what's causing this? And this is what keeps me up at night. When I go home, I think, what am I missing here? There must be some way to detect those children at risk. This is a family of eight, and one had died, and another one's having events, and we don't have that clue. We call it a phenotype. What is the factors, what are the characteristics of that patient that puts them at a higher risk, that separates them from the other child that doesn't have a risk? And we were struggling with that, trying to figure out which characteristics on the EKG, the electrical signals of the heart, on the echocardiogram, and there was no clue that we could find at the time. So at that point, we resort to treating them with medicine, and in some cases actually implanting a device that actually can shock them out of an abnormal heart rhythm should they have an event.
Is that like a pacemaker?
It's actually called an implantable cardioverter defibrillator. It's about the size of, well, if you put your thumb and
forefinger together, point your finger together, and make that circle. That's how big around it is. It's about as thick as about a half inch, and it inside that box. It's a computer chip. It's got a battery and a capacitor, and then it's got a long wire that goes into the heart. And that wire and the device is always detecting every heartbeat. And if the heartbeat goes too fast, it delivers a burst of energy, similar to if you have, if you watch the show ER and they put those patches outside your chest and they shock your heart. But this is all internal. And it's done within 20 seconds of the rhythm starting, 30 seconds.
So. Wow. And you actually brought one into the studio with you today. And thinking about implanting that in the chest of a child, it's a small device, and it's remarkable that it can be so small given what it does. But it seems so large to put into the chest of a child. I mean, that's a significant, a huge surgery, and that's something they'll carry with them forever?
Yeah. Putting the device in is not overly challenging. Living with the device is something different. And I don't think that this Mennonite family was all that concerned about the scar, but if you're a young teenage girl and you've got a scar on your chest and you want to go to the swimming pool, it has a huge impact. There's also the fact that you get if you get shocked during a baseball game while you're playing baseball and people see you collapsed, it puts you on the fringe of your peer group. Mm-hmm. And then teenagers will stop doing certain events. Like if it happened during baseball, they'll stop playing baseball. If it happened while they're swimming, they'll stop swimming. And then they won't go over to their friend's house because they don't want to have a sleepover and have an event happen. And they start living in this bubble. And much of what we do is helping them live their life with this device.
You mentioned that the family is Mennonite, which is significant in a couple of ways. Of course, we mentioned that there are a lot of children in this family, and that's pretty typical of Mennonite families. But also, and I want to bring Hannah into the conversation now, as well as a certified genetic counselor, the fact that this family is Mennonite is part of what led you to find out what was going on. Hannah, tell me a little bit more about how that plays into the scenario.
Sure. So as Dr. Law had mentioned, any time that we're trying to identify a new gene mutation that's never been previously discovered, family history is a really important tool that we use in this. And with this being a Mennonite family, first of all, it's a very, very large family. So there were, at least in our particular family, when we consider everyone included, there were over a dozen children who had died suddenly from cardiac events.
So we're talking really about cousins and
exactly extended cousins. Yep. The incredible thing about this particular community is they know their family history really well. And if they don't know the particular connection, they can talk to a family member and figure it out. So the communication amongst these members of these families is just impeccable.
Well, that sounds like an incredible gift to a genetic counselor.
It made my job very, very easy in that regard. Really, where my job came in was to figure out the Tetris of how do we connect the lines and how are all of these individuals related.
Well, and I just want to underscore, I mean, this is a family, a large extended family that had had children just dropping dead for years. How incredibly terrifying. So there's, you know, this huge emotional component to that. And I mean, Dr. Law, you mentioned the implications for a child who gets treated for this, but for a child who is also terrified that they're going to be next. This is a huge weight to carry.
There's no disease that's worse in my mind than the one that takes a child from its parents. And these parents not only knew about their own child, but knew about this community of children that had died. And they're challenging conversations because when they walk out the door of the hospital, they want to know that their child's going to be safe. And when you don't have a good clue, it's a challenge. When you're talking about those large extended families, I was talking to one father and he said, well, we're having a family reunion. Why don't you come down and draw blood and test all the children? And I'm thinking, that's a great opportunity, especially from a genetic counseling standpoint. And I said, but you know, to test them, we'd have to run them a treadmill, and then we have to bring in a lot of blood sampling kits. And he said, well, just have them run around the school, and we'll see what happens. I thought, well, that's a great idea, but that's pretty scary to see if children are going to drop when they're running around the school. So I said, I don't think we can do that. But they wanted to find the answer as much as we did, and they were willing to go to whatever extent they could.
Right. Well, and you mentioned the implanted device. That treatment, if I understand correctly, would only really be available to a child who's already survived one of these incidents until you figured out what was going on, right?
Right. So you would only implant them in the children that have had an arrest. And it becomes challenging because then the parents say, well, why does one child get one and the other one doesn't get an implantable device? And, of course, implantable device is not without risk. And so we take these implants very seriously because there can be infections. The device can treat abnormal rhythms, but it also can sometimes shock when it's not an abnormal rhythm. It's called an inappropriate shock. And those are just as devastating to the child as an appropriate shock. We have to consider all the ramifications before we put a device in. It's just not just simply just planting the device and walking away.
Right. So, Hannah, you start building these family trees and looking at the family history. We were talking about drawing blood. So tell me how you connect the family tree with the genes.
The first and foremost thing is trying to identify who are the members of the family that are going to give us the most information from genetic testing. So certainly starting with any child who has had a cardiac arrest, who has survived a cardiac arrest, or if we had a couple of patients who had passed away, but we actually had samples on that we could submit for testing as well. So we have to, from the larger family, figure out who are going to be the most important information, people that to test that are going to give us the most information. And then, you know, we got in contact with the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Mike Ackerman is a cardiology geneticist who studies new gene changes that can cause these heart arrhythmias. And we contacted his team and said, here's the situation. Would you be interested in taking this on? And within 10 minutes, we had a response from him.
We're going to have to pause right there. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Hannah Bombe, who is a licensed and certified genetic counselor at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and Dr. Ian Law. He is Division Director of Pediatric Cardiology and Director of the Electrophysiology Program at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We're talking about how their team discovered a as yet unknown genetic disorder that was leading to cardiac arrest in children of Mennonite families. We'll talk more in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com. Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
My guests right now, Dr. Ian Law. He is Division Director of Pediatric Cardiology and Director of the Electrophysiology Program at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He specializes in treating children with heart arrhythmias, and he led a team at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics that discovered an unknown genetic disorder that was causing children to die of cardiac arrest, or at least experience cardiac arrest. Hannah Bombe is also here. She's also part of this team and a licensed and certified genetic counselor at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. And this started with a Mennonite family where one child had died. A brother of that child survived a similar attack. As the research began at that point, another child in the family experienced a similar attack. And that sent you to try to find genetic information about this family and their extended family. And Hannah, we were talking earlier about how you found, you know, all of these cousins that had also these other families that had experienced things like this. You got in touch with the Mayo Clinic, and they were excited about this research because they had also been communicating with a Mennonite family that had a similar family history.
That's correct. Yep. So they had been in contact with another cardiologist and genetic counselor on the East Coast in Delaware, who also had a Mennonite family with very similar circumstances where they had, I believe it was at least four children who had died suddenly in a single family. And they had completed some initial genetic testing, but they were obviously very interested in our family as well to see if there was a link.
I mentioned earlier that the fact that the Mennonite community is so dedicated to keeping their family histories, that was a gift to you.
Absolutely.
But also similarly, the fact that there were so many children, so many family members who may have these genetic variables, while that was scary because any one of these children could have experienced an attack like that, that also gave you a huge sample size, right?
It did. And believe it or not, when we first started kind of opening the recruitment for this study, there was one week at work, I remember, where, boy, I would get off the phone and I would have three more voice messages from other family members who were interested in participating. So not only did we have a huge family here, but these community members were all very, very dedicated and interested in trying to figure out what's going on.
Oh, understandable. And you managed to gather a lot of people together to do sort of group testing, right, Dr. Law?
Yeah. So once we could identify those families that were at risk, we could bring them in. And one of the things about genetics is just it's beneficial sometimes to compare those that you believe that have the disease to those that don't have the disease. Now, at the time, we're struggling with determining who was at highest risk. But once we identified these families, it would bring them in. And there was a particular time when we drove out to do a clinic in Des Moines, and several families came up to have their blood drawn, and we communicated with Dr. Ackerman in Mayo Clinic, and he'd sent us down numerous test tubes for blood, and this is under an institutional review board study, so it was all approved, and the families provided their consent. And then we had the chore of bringing one child back at a time and drawing their blood. And the nurses, of course, were incredible at keeping track of all this, because if you mislabel a tube, it has significant consequences. But also the Mennonite children would walk in, they'd put their blood out, they'd put their arm out, we'd draw the blood, the babies. It was one of the most straightforward processes. Mm. And it was unique for the team. And then,
real
of course,
unified front, everyone searching for an answer.
Right. And everyone just walked in and they said, we're going to get this done. And it's like the babies knew what they were there for. And they walked on their mother's arms. I'm like, this is just amazing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then the process of sending the blood back to Mayo Clinic and then doing that same process took place in Delaware. And then they brought all the samples together and then the testing began, which was, it wasn't an overnight process. This is a long process.
Yeah, how long did it take?
This process probably started in 2017, 2018, a couple years.
Tell me about the aha moment when you figured out as a team that, okay, this one gene looks like the culprit.
Well, it was a long time coming. So I think we all felt guarded excitement because at least this was one potential answer that's what's going on with this family. Certainly, we can never rule out that if a person doesn't have these particular changes, that they still wouldn't be at increased risk for some type of heart arrhythmia due to another cause.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the tricky parts of this as well, is when you think you have an answer, we have to doubly make sure that that is the answer. You know, it's been a labor of love. We've definitely worked pretty hard to that moment, but guarded excitement, I would say.
You have isolated the gene RYR2, and this is a mutation.
Correct.
On that gene. So tell me what we know about this gene.
So it's called the ryanodine receptor, and that's the RYR2. It's a certain ryanodine receptor. And what makes the heart cells contract is calcium, in large part, rushes into the cell, and that causes contraction, and calcium gets reabsorbed. There's these little silos of calcium within these cardiac cells, and this calcium is constantly rushing into the cell and rushing back into these storage units. And when that calcium trafficking going in and out of the cell is disrupted, and the reannin receptor is what regulates that, then the cell can get overloaded with calcium. And at rest, when you're at rest, the calcium influx and efflux is actually relatively well controlled. But at high levels of exertion, when this calcium inflow and outflow is so much more rapid, their risk of arrhythmias goes up. And that's why these children were having these events during activities like playing baseball.
So, all right, a lot of us remember learning a little bit about genetics in our biology classes. And, you know, we did the little graphs and know about dominant genes and recessive genes. So in this case, in those terms, this is a recessive gene. So if two parents carry this mutation, then the child's at risk?
For this particular family, yes, this is a recessive condition. Yep. So the RYR2 gene is a gene that all of us have. We all have two copies of this gene. We get one from our mom and one from our dad. And it's a good gene. We want it to work properly. The problem arises is if there is a gene mutation where the gene doesn't work well. And that's exactly what Dr. Law was just explaining. So in this particular family, what we're finding is that these children who are at risk have inherited a copy of the gene from mom and a copy of the gene from dad that don't work properly. And that's what puts them at increased risk.
Now, I've talked about how the fact that you had access to a Mennonite community has been a real blessing in many ways. But that's also part of what has created this problem is that Mennonites very rarely marry outside of their faith. And so that has allowed this genetic mutation to spread.
Correct. So it's probably... not to say that this genetic mutation isn't found in other populations, because it certainly can be. Mm-hmm. We feel that this is probably just a higher proportion found in the Mennonite community because of the intermarrying.
All right. We have a lot of Mennonites who live in Iowa, and I'm sure that there are a number of people listening right now who think, oh, wow, what does this mean for me? So if I'm a parent or if I'm a prospective parent and I'm listening to this conversation, how do I respond?
Yeah. So I think, you know, first and foremost is knowing your family history. And for those individuals who might be listening, if you do have a family history of someone who has had cardiac arrest, talk with your family members. You know, if we need to get in contact with other people to make sure that the right people get evaluated in clinic, we certainly can do that. Anyone who has had symptoms, certainly passing out episodes and is also in this Mennonite family, we would strongly encourage a cardiac evaluation and further discussion to see if they are at risk.
And would you recommend genetic counseling if someone is considering becoming a parent?
Absolutely. Sure. Yep. So one of the misconceptions about genetic counseling is that it equals genetic testing. And certainly that's an important topic that we always discuss, but there's a lot more that goes into genetic counseling as well. There's a whole emotional aspect of this as well. So anytime that someone finds out that they themselves have a genetic condition or there is one in the family, that brings up a whole host of emotions. And sometimes you have to tease those out and discuss those before you can even get to the scientific portion of the discussion.
Dr. Law, you mentioned treating many members of this family and planting this device that can help them through a cardiac arrest. Tell me what it's like for somebody living with one of those devices, because now you know quite a few of them, right?
It's you know, to think that these two children in this family would no longer be here without this device. It's a remarkable device to be able to implant, and to think that these children wouldn't be around. And I think the families grasp that. You know, this Mennonite community who live fairly simple lives have been meshed with this highly sophisticated technology. And I've been in contact with a mother, and she was just in awe of the fact that we can actually test for this and then put a device in that saves her children's lives. You know, the stories when they come in the clinic and the two boys that we follow, they wear these jeans and these suspenders and these plaid shirts, and they come in, they're always smiling. And they'll tell me stories about how their device fired when they were out deer hunting. One boy was saying, I was looking at a deer, and then I was excited, and then I woke up and the deer was gone. And that was an event that he may have died without that device.
Right. Especially alone out there or with very few other people around him. Yeah.
So they're remarkable stories. One was one woman was jumping on a trampoline and had a cardiac arrest. But they're still here. And so the technology works. And that is an amazing thing. I mean, I have an amazing job. But there are certain moments that kind of crystallize why you do what you do.
That must be one of those moments. That's exciting. So tell me what's next for this research. This disorder does not have a name yet, right?
No.
Okay. So what are the next steps?
I think improving our collaboration. So certainly there are a large number of family members, community members that are in Iowa, but this family is also spread across the entire Midwest and beyond. And so really the next step for us is to further our collaboration with other cardiologists and other genetic counselors in other parts of the country so that when these family members raise concerns about, you know, my second cousin John in Ohio has concerns about this, then we have collaborators in Ohio who are aware of this, know what they're looking for, and can, you know, adequately treat these family members closer to home.
And the research portion of this, I mean, you've identified this mutation. What are the naming conventions? How does this become part of medical textbooks?
Well, I could name it after my daughter, I suppose, or something like that. You know, those are the things I don't think about as much. I mean, I could have a star named after me, I suppose. But, you know, I think what Hannah was alluding to is, you know, this was all research. And now with the research that's been published, now it becomes commercial. So these are now commercially available tests. But the commercially available tests have to have some rigorous research behind them before they can go public. And these are the things that there are pivotal points. And so for these families now, because Mayo Clinic cannot keep on testing thousands of people for this. Mm-hmm. So now there's a commercially available test, and the commercially available, the companies that are out there are now going to say, okay, this is a pathogenic or a disease-causing mutation. And so other Mennonite families don't have to go to the Mayo Clinic. They can go to a commercially available company.
And how long does that take for that to be available? Is it available now?
It's very close, and we've been in contact with Mayo Clinic.
So the mutation itself can now be identified on the commercially available genetic tests. Where we run into a little bit of issues that where the clinical labs are lagging just a little bit behind the research, which always occurs, is in the interpretation of the variant. So right now it's classified as they're calling a variant of uncertain significance, which in terms means that it's a change, but we don't know if it causes arrhythmias or not. We know that it does. So there's just a whole process that the clinical labs have to go through to upgrade that classification to pathogenic so that when anyone across the country orders or outside of the country orders this clinical test, they're getting a result back that says this is a disorder-causing change.
The story is incredible, and you talked about it took a long time. Really, in terms of discovering a disease or a genetic disorder, I mean, this seems like it happened really fast. And this is a field that is evolving so quickly. Can you give me a sense for the incredible potential of this kind of research?
Well, I'm going to start by saying when you have children that are dying,
it's not fast enough.
It's not fast enough. Yeah. So, and I agree that we were all thrilled, but during that time period, other children died, and we think about that as we move forward. That next time this happens, what can we do to speed the process up? But you know, medical knowledge, what we know about medicine, doubles about every 4 years, and so when we have a family that comes in with these challenging situations, I always have optimism, and I'm hoping that we can work quickly enough to have an impact on that family and then on the broader population.
Hannah, you want to add anything to that?
I would just very much second, actually, what Dr. Law mentioned, that, you know, these families have to live with this fear of who might be next every day. And we were quite lucky that it really only took a couple of years to find this answer. It could have been a lot longer. But the reason that it did go so quickly for this family was because of the family. This discovery would not have been made if it weren't for all of them lining up in, you know, exam rooms, offering their blood samples and really wanting that answer.
In doing your genetic research, you found that this was something that had affected many branches of this family. There was one family that had lost 5 of 7 children,
right?
Just devastating. Did you see that went back generations as well, or is this a fairly recent problem for the family?
So it has affected multiple generations, and although this is a recessive condition, and typically with recessive conditions, you wouldn't see multiple generations because of the marriage faith of this community, you can see recessive conditions in multiple generations. So yes, this is at least 3 generations that we've identified.
Well, thank you both so much for sharing this story with us today, and thank you for your work.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Charity.
Pediatric cardiologist Dr. Ian Law and genetic counselor Hannah Bombee of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We've been talking about the genetic mutation their team has discovered. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
Gary Porter was born in 1950, at the dawn of a new decade. He grew up in Greenfield, Iowa, a town of about 2,000 people, both then and now. He has captured moments from his childhood and slices of life in small-town Iowa in his memoir, Town Kid, Reflections of a Midwestern Boyhood. It's a collection of essays rich with memory and pictures. Porter is a distinguished lecturer at Drake University, where he taught accounting for many years, and he's on the line with us now. Hello, Gary.
Hello, how are you? I'm thrilled to be on. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. So tell me first, what leads an accounting professor to writing essays about his childhood and his hometown?
Well, that's probably a question I get more than almost any other one, is exactly that, an accounting professor doing creative writing. And I taught at a number of different universities, and I'm now, again, back affiliated with my alma mater at Drake. But I, early on in my career, Charity, started writing textbooks. And I found that whether you're talking about academic writing or whether it's creative writing, is the sort that I've done with Town Kid, you have to find some way to engage your audience. And in those early editions, we've now been through 10 editions of my accounting textbooks, we try and engage the audience with real-world examples. And how we did that early on was with examples from Ben & Jerry's ice cream in their annual report. So I learned early on the whole necessity of trying to engage the audience. When I first started creative writing, it was because we had lost our shelter dog, our love of our life, Duffy, and I wanted to find some way to memorialize our adopted dog. And so I said, Duffy's going to be a talking dog and one talking from up in heaven. So I've always subscribed to the idea of trying to find a way that you can interest somebody in that topic, whether it's college freshmen trying to learn about debits and credits, or whether it's trying to, again, bring back those days from when I was growing up in Greenfield.
These essays that you've collected together, I get the sense that they were written, some of them at different times, sparked by different memories that maybe were published in the local newspaper. But you also had your high school class reunion driving you to put this collection together. Tell me about that.
I sure did. And that's probably because my wife, Melissa, reminded me. Yes, the essays had been written over a period of time, but when we got down to about that last year before my significant class reunion, shall we say, my 50th, actually back in Greenfield, Melissa said, you know, you really need to get these finished and out there for not only the people in Greenfield and throughout the Midwest, but really for your classmates as kind of a tribute to them. So that was, again, the impetus at the end. I had been sending essays into the Adair County Free Press, our local newspaper, prior to that for a few years, had done some classes to get more involved rather than textbooks into creative writing, and had taken a class up at the Loft in Minneapolis that was zeroed in on just writing about your hometown. And then I actually spent a week there in Iowa City at the Iowa Summer Writing Festival learning more about creative writing. So yes, but you're exactly right. The class reunion was what really put it over the top, I guess you would say.
Well, these essays are so evocative of life in Greenfield, and it's really a love letter to Greenfield, Iowa. Although, even as somebody who lived part of my childhood in a small town in Iowa in the 1970s, so many of the elements ring true. But why don't you tell us specifically about Greenfield? What do you feel makes your town special?
Well, I'm a bit biased, obviously, that Greenfield is so special to me, as I think everyone's hometown is. We all have hometowns. But for me, it was really the people and places that I recall so vividly from those days in 1950s and the early 1960s when I was that town kid growing up in the small town. And as you said in the lead-in, Charity, it's Greenfield, southwest of Des Moines, about an hour. And again, you said 2,000 population then and now. It is the county seat, and that's something that is brought into a number of these essays, the fact that we were the county seat with the town square and the county courthouse.
And you kind of stole the county seat is also a story that you bring up. There's a controversy about which town should be the county seat in Adair County.
That's exactly right. I don't know if that's that unusual. I've heard that about other county wars as well. But Fontenelle, the town west of Greenfield, 5 miles, claimed it at one time. But eventually, many, many years ago, Greenfield brought the records over and has been the county seat. And we do like to say that Adair County is the number one county. You may recall back when the license plates in Iowa had the numbers corresponding to the counties alphabetically. And so no question, my county of Adair has always been the number one county in the state. So.
Well, the story of how Greenfield became the county seat is such a good one. Before it was even decided in the courts, it was something that the two towns had battled over. But people from Greenfield actually took it upon themselves to go to Fontenelle and physically take the records?
That's my understanding. Yeah, my understanding from some of the research I did and looking back at the old, some of the archives of the old newspapers is that is exactly what happened. That, you know, I don't know if they went back and forth more than once, but in the end, Greenfield won out and has been the county seat for many years.
You lived right across the street from the swimming pool in Greenfield.
I did.
And I think a lot of us remember those small town swimming pools, and hopefully kids still have that experience at least to a degree today. But in so many ways, during the summer months, the swimming pool was the beating heart of a small town. Tell me about your pool.
Well, it's still there to this day. Sadly, my house has since been torn down. It's the victim, you hear that phrase so much anymore, tear down. And there's now a new house built where mine stood on the north side of town. But yeah, the swimming pool is still there. And a couple of the essays in the book are kind of a tribute to that swimming pool and the lifeguards and everyone that worked there. But as a young kid, and I'm sure many listeners from that era can recall that we were back and forth all day long, bugging the lifeguards and seeing how many times we could come in and out of the pool in any one day. So that's where everything happened in the summertime, was at the pool as well as the balls yards, the place where we played baseball and touch football throughout the summertime. But for me, Charity, one of the things that I find important in what I've written for the type of writing I do is the use of sensory images. And so many things that I can recall from that pool have to do with my senses, that I seriously can still smell that chlorine from the pool and feel it in my eyes from that first time you dove into the deep end of the pool. And I still hear to this day, some of your listeners, particularly those closer to Des Moines, recall that it's still there today, KIOA radio. And I can remember KIOA radio playing in the bathhouse in the background. So, you know, the pool was a special place to me growing up.
You write about some of your favorite people in town, and we don't have time to really talk about each one of them. But one of the things that I'm really struck by, not just the freedom that you had as a child about town, the kind of freedom that it's hard to recreate for our kids today, but also the relationships that you had with adults who weren't part of your family. I mean, it strikes me that there was a lot more interaction between the generations back then.
Oh, absolutely. And I write about some of those in the collection. One of them is my pipe-smoking neighbor two doors down, Pete Funk. I had a special relationship with him. He was a laborer. He worked all day driving a county maintainer, smoothing out our gravel roads. And I have so many memories, particularly in the summertime, of going over there and sitting on Pete's porch and him and I discussing the issues of the day. And we would look out and the young people would be cruising by in their cars and circling around the swimming pool block there. And so we hung out together. And you're exactly right. He wasn't related, but he was very important. There was the Irish priest just on the other side, actually, of the swimming pool, who was such an influence on me growing up. Having come from Ireland to the new country, he was the one who taught us young kids about kicking a soccer ball and so much more than just being an altar boy. And gosh, my football coach, who had made such a impact on me and was frankly one of the reasons that I ended up going up to Drake. So.
The year that you graduated from high school was 1968.
Yeah.
I mentioned that you were born in 1950, but graduating from high school in 1968, that was such a momentous year for our nation. And of course, being a senior in a high school, you had big worries and concerns and, you know, passions of your own. But tell me a little bit the climate, the social climate of 1968 as you and your classmates came of age.
Yeah, you're exactly right. There's both the things that were going on nationally and around the world, such a monumental year. And then I really write in that one essay about what it was like being a high school senior that year. And of course, the Vietnam War was raging. In April, we had the assassination of Martin Luther King, followed not long after we graduated, just by a few weeks, with Bobby Kennedy's assassination out in California. And then I was off to Drake, up to Des Moines for college by August of that year. So it's so interwoven, all of it. I write in the book that obviously, as a high school senior, these worldwide events had such an impact on all of us that had grown up there. But, you know, at the same time, I was looking for playing time on the basketball team. I was concerned about whether I'd get my dad's car to drive around on the weekend. So it was a real mix of emotions and recollections I have about that year in 1968.
Greenfield, Iowa, as we've talked about, a very small town, both then and now. But there was a major moment of fame for Greenfield, Iowa, because Norman Lear, the famous director and writer, decided to come to town. Tell me about that.
Well, he did decide to, as we say, discover Greenfield. That was 50 years ago, just this past summer. And he had decided he was going to make a movie about an entire town that would stop smoking. And of course, smoking, as we know, was so much more prevalent back in that time period. So he came to town in tow with the likes of Dick Van Dyke and Bob Newhart and others to make this movie about an entire town that would go cold turkey. So some of your listeners may recall that movie, Cold Turkey, which really, again, put Greenfield on the map. We always say there are other towns in the area that had bit parts in the movie, but Greenfield was kind of the star of that. And that was so important and something that the town has been celebrating over this past year, given that hard to believe that it's been 50 years since that movie.
One of the really wonderful things about your collection of essays are the photographs that go along with those essays. And we've talked in the past on this program, it's been a while, about the Seide collection in Greenfield. Mm-hmm. Just a treasure trove of photos and journalism through the years. There's a wonderful Iowa PBS documentary about it. But tell me about your access to these photos and how you were able to find the photos you were looking for.
Yeah, that really was because of the help and assistance of Linda Seide. Linda now is the owner and the protector, if you will, of the all of those black and white photos that were in the Adair County Free Press. The Seide family had run the Adair County Free Press for four generations, and they've since sold, and it is no longer part of the Seide family, but Linda has been the one who has collected all of those photos, digitized them up to a certain point in time, and again, helped keep that that going. I worked very closely with her to try and pick out a majority of the photos. The old black and white photos that lead off each essay are from that Seide collection. So I worked hand in hand with her, not only in picking out the photos, but also in finding excerpts from the old issues of the Adair County Free Press from that time period. And then just as a bit of background, too, some of your listeners may be familiar with Hugh Seide, who was part of that four generations of photojournalists. Hugh went off to Washington, D.C. in the 1950s, and from Eisenhower through George W. Bush, he chronicled the presidents for Time magazine. And so one of my essays, you talked earlier here, asked me about people and places. And one of these essays is a tribute to Hugh Seide, just simply titled Hugh, because he, we'd like to think, is our most native son of Greenfield. But it was such a thrill to work with the family. Besides Linda Seide, Cindy Seide Buck, who still lives in the D.C. area but comes back every summer because she's so passionate about our town that she wrote the foreword for the book. So there's a real special connection, and I'm thrilled that we're able to include those photographs in the book.
Well, Gary, what a wonderful time capsule you've created. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, and if people can go to facebook.com/thetownkid if they want to connect with us, and they'd be happy to do programs.
All right. Well, Gary, thanks a lot. Gary Porter is the author of Town Kid, Reflections of a Midwestern Boyhood. He wrote a collection of essays about his childhood in Greenfield, Iowa. He was born in 1950. You've been listening to an encore edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.